Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast that makes art house, indie, and classic cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and on this episode, we are wrapping up season 3 of the podcast, which has been all about classic film essentials. The last 6 episodes have broken down some of the biggest titles of the classic era, giving all the historical and story context you need, whether you're a beginner or a film expert. This final episode is about a biggie, and possibly the greatest film of all time, Citizen Kane. Just before we get to that, I want to go ahead and preview next season of the podcast. Art House Garage is all about classic indie and art house films. We've been doing a series on classic film, but now we are going to turn our attention to our namesake, art house cinema. And we're going to keep a similar focus, a gateway, a way in, a beginner's guide of sorts. We are calling it the Art House Starter Pack. I'm very excited to get into it. We'll be looking at 6 of the biggest films in the art house world across a variety of time periods and countries. I'm excited to announce right now the titles we will be discussing. First up, from 1953, Tokyo Story, from Japanese director Yasujiro Ozu. Next, from 1957, The Seventh Seal, from Swedish filmmaker Ingmar Bergman. Fast forwarding then to 1979, the film is Stalker, from Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky. After that, we'll be looking at 1985's Vagabond, from French auteur Agnès Varda. Then we will look at 1993's Blue, from the Three Colors trilogy by Polish director Krzysztof Kieślowski. And finally, from 2011, we'll discuss The Tree of Life, from American director Terrence Malick. I'm very excited to watch all of these, and I'm excited to announce the guest who will be joining me for the entirety of Season 4, Andrew Camarillo. Andrew is a filmmaker and a photographer who previously joined me on the podcast back in Season 1 to discuss the film Synecdoche, New York, which, by the way, is the most popular episode of this podcast ever. I really love Andrew's thoughtful take on movies, and I can't wait for him to join in and discuss these films. I have actually only seen 2 of these films before, so it's going to be my first time for most of them. I'm very, very excited for that. Back to today, we are looking at Citizen Kane, often called the best movie of all time. What is this movie about? Well, here's what IMDb says. Following the death of publishing tycoon Charles Foster Kane, reporters scramble to uncover the meaning of his final utterance, Rosebud. And that sums it up pretty well, but it leaves out the fact that this film is also tightly tied to American history, and it's full of incredible technical innovations too, not to mention the story unfolds beautifully in a non-linear fashion. That's probably enough to get you started, so let's get on to the discussion. Quick note, we do get into the ending of this film, but we give a spoiler warning before we do so. Now, here is my discussion with Rance Collins about the incomparable Citizen Kane.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction. It's certainly coming to this theater, and I think our Mercury actors make it an attraction.
I'd like you to... Hello again, Rance Collins. Thanks for being back. How are you?
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Yes, I agree.
Alive. It's good to be alive.
Yes. Still in the time of coronavirus now. So, yeah, just good to hear other people's voices and talk about a shared experience like Citizen Kane, which is what we're talking about today. This movie, Citizen Kane, has a humongous legacy in cinema history. Number one of AFI. Both the lists that they've done, at the top of Sight and Sound for years running for a long time. It's a big deal, and it's one that I had actually never seen. So I was really happy to finally check this one off and see it. But
it's one of those movies that I feel like if everybody's heard the name Citizen Kane, everybody's heard this movie title before, and people haven't necessarily seen it though, because you know, everybody hears like, oh yeah, best movie ever made, Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
And then they don't, you know, nobody, there's something about a movie that is critically considered great. Mm. It's kind of like, you know, like, ah, man, yeah, Anna Karenina. Mm. I know, yeah, great book.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of a turnoff to the average moviegoer, maybe, if critics really love it.
They're like, oh, man, I guess I have to sit down. There's something about something that seems like it's high art that makes it feel like, without looking at it, it feels like a schlog, you know?
Yeah.
And so we're tackling that right now, because this is different. This is different, I think, than Casablanca, because, you know, Casablanca is another movie that maybe has a similar amount of clout around it. Mm-hmm. But Casablanca is a little bit more of a traditional popcorn film than Citizen Kane is.
Yeah.
Citizen Kane is a little bit more highfalutin, you know, but there's a reason that it ranks so highly on all of these lists. And we need to digest, we need to dissect. I was going to say digest, but we should do that, but we should also dissect.
Yes. All the DI words that we can apply to this movie. Here we go.
Words are great.
Well, Citizen Kane, so I had not even much kind of context for what it was about. I knew that it told a man's life kind of in bits and pieces, and that's true. It tells about Citizen Kane, who is Charles Foster Kane, who is played by Orson Welles, who also directed this, and we'll talk about him in a minute. He's a big deal.
Just you should know on the onset, before you listen to anything else we say, he turned 26 the year this movie came out.
Just what have I done with my life that he made the greatest movie ever taught?
We're in our 30s, and
I'll have you know, I'm actually 29.
Oh, are for, you sorry
until August. Sorry. So there's
we're August what,
26th?
Oh, I'm August 1st.
Wow, look at that.
You were the same month but different astrological signs.
Missed that divine.
So close.
What a shame.
I know.
Well, Charles Foster Kane is the lead here, is the protagonist, and he's kind of based on some real life, I think more than one person from what I understand, but primarily William Randolph Hearst, who is a real historical figure. But Charles Kane is a newspaper magnate and a businessman and a politician, and the movie opens with his death. So we see what I was mentioning before, kind of some surprisingly avant-garde, kind of experimental looking shots, and like we see through some broken glass at one moment, and it's kind of hazy for a second, but we see a snow globe fall to the ground and break, and then we hear the word Rosebud, and that's kind of all we see, and then it jumps into this newsreel that's pretty lengthy, and it kind of tells some of the context of who he was, like it's an obituary, I guess. And it says he lives in this palace called Xanadu, and he was a newspaper man and a politician and all this stuff, and just kind of scratches the surface. And then that ends, and we're in the newsroom with these guys who have just made this newsreel, and say, you know, it needs a little something else. Why don't we figure out what his last words, Rosebud, that has to have a significant meaning. Let's investigate that. Let's drill down. And so then for the rest of the movie, we're following this investigative journalist who is talking to his ex-wives and his business partners, and we're learning little bits and pieces. And one of the most amazing things, I think, is just how out of order this is told, because it starts at the end, but it really jumps all over the place. It's not like it just has a flashback here and there. It's like primarily flashbacks, and they don't all go in order, and yet it feels really cohesive, and you never get lost of where you are in time. So that's kind of what that's about.
Probably starts with that you know, you mentioned how it starts with the newsreel. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, it starts with him saying Rosebud, and then it shows the newsreel. So from the very beginning, you are given a nice overview of his entire life, mm-hmm. as the quote unquote public yeah, knows it. Mm-hmm. And then you take the facts that you know, and the people that you met in that newsreel, and then you dissect that, as we said a second ago. And you go back and you start on this path to find out what Rosebud means, which is really, I mean, the core of the movie is you ultimately discover that Rosebud is the thing he hung on to, is the existential thing he held on to his whole life. Yeah. But, which maybe in a little while will spoil what Rosebud is. I feel like a lot of people have probably heard what it is at this point.
Yeah.
it's one of those like Norman Bates' mother situations.
Yeah, well known.
Wow, I hope so everybody listening has seen Psycho. sorry. Anyway, you know, it's there's just some things that become like cinema.
In jokes, kind of.
Yeah, in jokes, you know, like, you know, Snape isn't actually a bad guy. I don't know. Like, you know, there's just things that you know through osmosis. Mm-hmm. But anyway, which I only recently went through all the Harry Potters, so I shouldn't have used that analogy. I avoided it for so long. And then I finally watched them all. And okay, I get it. I get why people like them.
I'm glad you've had that experience. Sorry to get distracted on Harry Potter.
I haven't read.
Okay, that's my question. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Well. I just like, I don't know. When I was a kid, I didn't like things that were popular.
Yeah.
And so I feel like lots of cinephiles can probably relate to that statement because, you know, we buck the trends. Yeah. We want to discover the artsy stuff. That's
so funny that you say that, because when I was a kid, I wanted to read it desperately because I was at like a pretty conservative Christian school, and it was a little bit like a rebellion. Oh, he's reading that wizard book. And so that was my experience of it.
Yeah, I forget that very Harry much Potter so. It's huge. I don't think that exists as much as it used to. I don't know if
I think that's true.
I feel like it's I mean, like lots of people I knew at our very conservative Baptist university still really liked Harry Potter, so it's not as big a thing.
It was pretty uncommon, I think, but anyway, yes.
I mean, but still. Anyway, much like Harry Potter, Charles Foster Kane has to go on a journey to discover it. No, I don't know.
It's a beautiful transition, yeah.
Much like Hogwarts, Xanadu, his home.
It's a huge pass. So we start to talk to his different loved ones through his life, and we see his growing up. One of the first places he goes, this journalist goes to learn more about him, is to read the journal of who was this person who was basically a father figure to Charles Kane. And we see his childhood, and for like just one scene, really. But his family was very poor. Yeah, go ahead.
In the vault, right?
Yes, in the vault. Yeah, so it's like a... Yeah, it's like it feels like a bank vault, but it's like a library, or maybe it is a vault. I'm not sure, but it's like under lock and key
somewhere. And he has to go in and have to get it.
It's very like,
and that's one of those first. I mean, like, there's lots of set pieces in this movie that you are going to remember, but that is a set and a way that the set is shot that is so stark and full of all these right angles.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
And like the lighting the architecture.
It's everything has kind of a dreamlike Salvador Dali feel about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. When Greg he walks, Tolan, go ahead. That, yeah.
Greg Tolan did the cinematography, who also did the cinematography for Best Years of Our Lives that we talked about last week.
There you go. That's
very cool. Differently shot film.
Yeah, very different. When he walks into that vault room, I had this feeling like, oh, this feels like a sci-fi movie. And I think I realized it's like, it flashed me back to watching Blade Runner, which of course came years later, but I think borrows. So, and you see a lot of things have borrowed from this movie. over the years. Blade Runner, mm-hmm. actually, towards the end, there's something that's exactly the ending of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That
I was like, oh my gosh, that's direct parallel that I never knew must have been intentional. But
you know, I don't know if I had actually, I don't know if I had processed, mm-hmm. like I with the second you said it, I knew exactly what you meant, mm-hmm. but I don't know if I had processed that, how direct that connection was.
Yeah,
until this, it's
probably
moment.
Because I never have seen this before until this week, but I have watched Indiana Jones 100 times, and so that ending immediately sparked that in my brain. It's like, oh my gosh, Spielberg stole this. This is great. Yeah,
I mean, you know, I mean, Spielberg was is one of the directors that really sprung out of I don't know, you wouldn't say he was the second generation director. He was like a third or fourth generation director, but he was of the first generation of film school directors. Mm. And so Spielberg came along at a time, along with Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, where you really get this influx of film directors who are the first crop that have been taught film. Mm. Mm-hmm. As something educational.
Mm-hmm. Kind of learning the formal techniques, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and learning older films as a textbook as opposed to just entertainment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So so Spielberg is interesting. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really thought about that. It's funny that he's been around for so long too. He started so young.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like film schools have been around forever now, but it makes sense that Spielberg would be paying homage to such films, because whenever he was at film school, I mean, I'm sure Citizen Kane was, you know, top of the list movie that they were learning about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was the first time it was, he was of the first generation that sprung forth out of film being considered academia.
Mm, yeah,
they're of the first who come forth thinking that cinema is an art form.
Yeah,
so
and so you can see how influential this movie was as you're watching it. So it starts there, and he's a child, and he's got this sled outside, and so I had to actually kind of pause and like figure out what was happening here. But his parents are very poor, basically, but they had come into some money because they found out their land was on like a diamond mine or an oil mine or something like that.
Yeah.
And so essentially they send their son, Charles Kane, off to be raised by someone else. Which is that something that was common at that time? Do you know anything about like that process and why that happened?
I don't know. People had so many kids back then. They probably, I think they were just considered like, you know, something that they were like currency at the time.
Yeah. Yes. You know? I was like, what is happening? Is this trafficking? Like, what is going on?
There was no birth control. There was no,
I guess it was like a sense of he'll have a better life if he doesn't grow up here in this very rural middle of nowhere.
Yeah. That's how I took it.
So he goes off to live with this rich kind of banker kind of guy. And that's whose journal.
And it should be noted that even though she's only briefly in the film, the person who plays his mother is Agnes Moorehead. Mm-hmm. And Agnes Moorehead this is her first film appearance, but she becomes one of the most popular character actors of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Mm-hmm. Gets several Oscar nominations, including one for Orson Welles' second film, The Magnificent Ambersons. Mm-hmm. And she becomes best known to audiences, probably much to her chagrin, for playing Endora on the television sitcom Bewitched.
Underwitched, yeah.
Yeah, but she is in a whole bunch of movies. I mean, just let me rattle off a few titles.
Her top one is Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte is her number one on IMDb.
That is a really fun Baby Jane-esque Betty Davis movie where she is unrecognizable as like this slovenly person.
Wow.
But yeah, she's also in How the West Was Won, which has everybody and their mother. And she is in a movie called Pollyanna. She's in a great, great kids movie, Pollyanna. I say it's a great kids movie. It's also one of the saddest movies that you could possibly watch. But have you seen Pollyanna?
I have not.
Mm-mm. Oh, God. It takes a turn. It's like this is happy, happy girl who's just making everyone's lives better because she has a positive attitude, and then gets really dark really quick.
Wow.
But anyway, she's a great character actor. She made a ton of movies throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And this is her film debut.
And that brings up an interesting point. When you said she's also in his second movie, that means, yes, Citizen Kane was his first feature, Orson Welles' first feature, which is also pretty remarkable.
Yeah. And I mean, like, and a lot of the people in this movie, a lot, this is the start of a career for many of the people who were in the film, including the guy who plays his best friend in the movie, Joseph Cotten, who the next year makes Shadow of a Doubt, which we had the other lead from that movie in Best Years of Our Lives last week. But Shadow of a Doubt's a great Hitchcock film that he's in, and he becomes a very popular leading man in the 40s and 50s. And he has a long career. He's also in The Third Man, which Orson Welles is in as well, obviously. And there's a lot of character actors in this movie who end up becoming very popular, but a lot of them were involved in the Mercury Players, which was a troupe of performers that Orson Welles had assembled, who did theatrical productions in New York and did radio plays in the Mercury Radio Theater, which the first thing that really made Orson Welles a buzzword,
buzz name, War of the Worlds,
was his adaptation of H.G. Wells's War of the Worlds, which was done like a news report and supposedly had lots of people thinking that there were actual aliens.
Yeah, it's a radio drama, right?
Yes, it was a radio drama. People supposedly like committed suicide over the
broadcast. Actually aliens coming. So it was such a realistic like.
How much of that's press and how much of that is real is another question. But you can listen to that radio broadcast on the internet if you would like to. And so that's where he really sprang forth. And then because he was doing all these impressive things on radios, he got this basically carte blanche contract with RKO Radio Pictures to do whatever the hell he wanted to do. And that only lasted really for one movie because Citizen Kane did not become the financial success that it might have had William Randolph Hearst not actually existed. Because William Randolph Hearst kind of suppressed the film as much as possible because it is very thinly veiled take on his life.
Yeah, it's pretty damning.
And it is pretty damning, not totally without empathy, but you know, does have something to say and would not be a favorable portrait by any means. And so he had his mass newspaper syndicate empire basically lambast the film and threaten people who, you know, threatened anything that he had any type of power over, who were going to show the movie or whatever the case may be. And that really curbed its success, even if it did pick up quite a few Oscar nominations that year. And really it is, it still got a great, obviously critical reputation from non-Hearst papers. It really is film school and college kids, you know, trying to be artsy in the 60s and 70s that brought this movie back into light in the mainstream. And the reception that it got from students of films overseas, you know, the Jean-Luc Godards and Fran oh my gosh, I can't say his name. Truffaut.
Yeah, Francois. Yeah.
Francois, thank you.
yes, yes.
Francois Truffaut. Like that set of Fellini, you know, all of them, they're the ones who, them combined with film schools, are really the reason this movie came back into the public consciousness and is now known to be the great film that it is.
Yeah.
But that's, even though he was given all this freedom with this movie to basically do whatever he wanted to do, because it didn't lead to such mammoth success, his next film, Magnificent Ambersons, ended up being very cut up by the studio. And the director's cut is not known to exist today.
Wow.
And then he had another movie he was supposed to make for RKO, and it ran very much, it was like a documentary-ish feature, and it ran very much over budget and had lots of problems, and then he ended up parting ways with RKO. And from there, his directing career goes in a lot of fits and starts, and he takes a lot of acting jobs to help pay the bills here and there, not necessarily because of quality, but he does he does make a couple more movies of significance, including The Lady from Shanghai and Touch of Evil.
Yeah,
but it's interesting, but because of his uniqueness and his ahead of the time feeling about him, he doesn't ever really match the success again, even though he was only 26 when the movie was released.
It's really interesting. I think so. Yeah. Not even having seen, before I ever saw anything that he starred in or made, I had an idea that he was just like this creative genius. Like that's the vibe that I had for some reason. That's his reputation a little bit, that just incredibly creative, yeah, ahead of his time.
And certainly
kind of
he was. I mean, yeah. This movie is, you know, I don't think he was necessarily a one trick pony. I think that he was curbed by circumstance more than anything else, you know?
That's really interesting. So I guess kind of getting back, so you mentioned a little bit of the William Randolph Hearst connection there. So from the childhood scene, we basically go on, he doesn't want to take his new father figure's money, but he does want the newspaper. He really feels strongly about that. And then it shows his prominence as a newspaper tycoon, I guess, that the way he's controlling information is really interesting. And there's lines about, like, if you put it in a big headline, then it becomes news. And then, like, and like someone saying, oh, that's not news. And then he's saying, like, we'll make it news. And then
there's like a subtle indictment of tabloid yellow journalism there.
That's really interesting. And the way that intersects with politics comes in, and that is so fascinating for today. And I want to get to that. And you were mentioning like newspaper headlines. This was the way everyone experienced the news. And so if you, he just understood that if you control that information, you can be incredibly powerful. And so that's what you see happening. And then he has a couple of marriages along the way. And there's some of the details of that is important to the political part as well. But again, all told in bits and pieces and kind of in lots of flashbacks. But so he runs for governor, and there's a few lines where they say, oh, one day you'll be president. So he just had this feeling of ambition, like people knew that he was going to be a big deal. And he's just incredibly driven. And he runs for governor and is doing very, very well with that. But I guess backing up just a little bit, he has had an extramarital relationship with his first wife is Emily is her name, and she is like the niece of the president or something like that. So she's kind of like, it's like a marriage of royalty almost, and that is a bit rocky and tumultuous, but more or less stays strong, it seems like. And they have a child and all of that, but then he meets that scene where he meets who becomes his second wife, Susan, she doesn't know who he is. And that's like the reason he likes her. Like,
can we talk about,
yeah,
can we
go
talk
ahead
about that shot that, that of Susan when she's sitting in the bar, and it starts. It's raining, and it starts outside this skylight window, and it goes through the window
Yes, that's right.
and to the table where she's drinking, it obviously very heavily. That entire, I mean, like, I just want to call out some of the technical innovations that are happening the whole time. Like the footnote to everything you were saying about the plot is that it is framed and shot in a way that is so beyond anything that was happening at the time, and is also like, it's artsy, but it's also so dynamic
And the
and
editing of it too.
different. Yes. Oh, and there's so much going on in the quick cutting of the way the editing. I mean, I just like just know that everything you're saying plot wise is told in a
It's
symphonic technical way.
like there's a moment with editing where it, like half of the screen fades to another thing, and because it's in black and white, like it's a fully black section fades into a different image, and it almost suggests the way they're recalling this and it's a memory. It's really interesting, and like the visual plays into the plot as well in a way that's it's genius. And that's I think part of a huge part of the reason for this film's legacy. But yeah, it's really amazing. And the scene where speaking of great shots, where we first meet Susan, well, I guess we first meet her in the future and after his death, and she is drinking herself like blackout drunk every night. It seems like she's in a really bad place. But then we see when they first meet, and the first shot is really incredible because it's just like a drugstore, and we see a car come rushing past the camera, and then it pans over and we see, oh, Charles Foster Kane was standing there and got horribly splashed by the mud of it. And so you kind of put the pieces to that together, and then that ends up being the reason that they connect. She's like, oh, you can come into my apartment and I can clean you up because you're all covered in mud. And then, yeah, she has no idea who he is, and he's incredibly attracted to that for some reason. That he seems like he's a man. I think they say this in the movie. He's a man who wants what he can't have, kind of. And so somehow reconnects to the person that he really is if they don't know the persona that he's become, I guess, because he's a big deal in society. So anyway, that happens, and then he has this huge political campaign. One of the images from this movie that you see on IMDb and stuff is him standing in front of an enormous portrait of himself, and that kind of captures at least that era of his life, because you
I have
really
to go to
see his
IMDb
whole
and look
life.
at this portrait because I want to make sure I'm looking, thinking about the right shot. Anyway, keep talking. Oh, the one,
It's like
you
he's
mean
at a
the
rally.
famous, whenever he's during the governor campaign, right? And that's another one of those famous shots too, because the introduction to that, to him on the podium, is it starts kind of far away, and it closes into this shot of him at that podium with that with the big campaign portrait behind him, and it's from this kind of low angle looking up at him where he's this larger than life figure.
Which just totally plays into that whole like if he's controlling the information, like he can make himself huge if he literally just makes a giant poster of himself, like that kind of. And there's like a level of he's controlling that and he understands that, but also a level of he's so full of himself that he sees no issue with it. Which this is the part that I want to bring in a little bit of modern day, because I want to hesitate to compare anyone to our current president, and we don't necessarily have to get too political, but I could not help but feel some similarities there. And more, I mean, in modern times, it's how well can you control social media, right? And be the loudest person on the news, and that leads to success. But you definitely feel kind of glimmers of that in Citizen Kane as he's controlling information to gain prominence, I guess.
Yeah, no, totally. That's exactly what's happening. It's this that allegory that we just never seem to grasp or learn from in any way, shape, or form, where we're continually taught this story about small men seeking riches and wealth and fame and you know, doing anything at all costs to make that happen. Mm-hmm. And we continually just buy into them because they're they posture themselves to be to be something great. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. And again, like all of this is based on a real life person, William Randolph Hearst, who interestingly, if you want to know more about that story, there was an HBO film
made about that.
It's called RKO 281, right. And it has Liev Schreiber as Orson Welles.
Wow.
And James Cromwell is William Randolph Hearst, and Melanie Griffith is Marion Davies, who was his mistress, who is the composite for Susan.
Okay.
And she actually, Marion Davies actually had a pretty significant film career, not as a singer. She was more of a comedian. But the thing with, the thing was, William Randolph Hearst wanted her to be a serious actress, even though comedy was what she was good at. And so he kept putting her in these ridiculous over-the-top dramas or musicals when what she wanted to do was comedy. and so that's very similar to the storyline with his second wife, not Susan, where he's forcing her to be this operatic singer when that isn't what she can do.
She's not,
and she's not good at it.
Everyone knows it, and he just keeps pushing.
But he keeps pushing it anyway,
and that destroys her and their relationship in the end.
So if you want to know more about the real life story that this is based on, there is a pretty good little HBO movie that came out in the late 90s called RKO 281. It's called RKO 281 because that was the production.
Yeah.
No, it was the number of the production,
I think,
RKO 281. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So it's really good. Yeah. And the story behind the movie is almost as fascinating as the movie itself. So
I'll be definitely looking that up, and I'll try to link that in the show notes if I can find that, the IMDb at least. But so yes, I definitely felt that the kind of modern political resonance with it. I think where that falls apart is that Citizen Kane, Charles Kane, does do something bad enough to get in trouble, basically. And that is, this affair comes out, and that's a fascinating scene where the political opponent is basically putting pressure on him, like saying, I'm going to release this story and destroy your life and destroy your campaign. And he's stubborn enough that he says, do it unless you cede and all this stuff.
I mean, it probably wouldn't, an affair probably wouldn't ruin it now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Mean. Like, that was the only thing. I was like, well, this is so feels so modern. Oh, wait, no, that would not have mattered.
That sadly. Would not.
Yeah.
That nobody would care.
Yes. So there's that aspect of it. So then the last, I guess, part of the, so he loses the governorship. And then the last section of the movie, you see a lot of his second wife, Susan's, that we were just mentioning. And when she eventually leaves him, and that's very dramatic as well. And then, yeah, so I guess that's kind of an overview of the plot. That's kind of a big overview because there's a lot of little details of different things happening and other characters I haven't mentioned yet. But then, I don't know, do we want to talk about the very ending? I guess we can.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, I think that they've had, I mean, like, they can pause and go watch the movie. Yeah. Otherwise, you've had, you know, 70 something years to see this, nearly 80 years.
Yeah.
So,
here we go. Spoiler warning for the end of Citizen Kane.
Spoiler warning. Rosebud's a sled.
Yes, Rosebud is a sled. But it's what I think is so amazing about that. Again, so I knew Rosebud was a sled, but I didn't really know much more beyond that. But I, so it's amazing, and it goes through this whole man's life, but it keeps that emotional core. So another thing that kind of differentiates it from, I don't know, real life figures like President Trump, is that it doesn't completely villainize him like you might expect. It maybe sounds like I'm talking about a total villain, but like you mentioned earlier, Rance, it really empathizes with him too, and the other people around him. Even though you recognize he's doing a lot of terrible things, and It kind of is digging into why. And so we find out, yeah, at the very end that Rosebud is his childhood sled, and no one ever figures that out except the camera. Like, the audience knows, but the journalist
Which
doesn't.
Is the brilliant thing. The journalist, you know, walks off and he never gets his story.
Yeah.
And that's where you have the Raiders of the Lost Ark imagery that you were, or the imagery that they riff, where you start, you know, like, they have collected this Xanadu, which is based on the Hearst Castle, which is a place you can visit here in California. You have this mammoth place with all this, you know, stuff.
Statues
and crates and crates and crates. And they're throwing a bunch of items that they don't need into an incinerator. Mm. And they see the sled and, you know, someone's like, oh, this isn't important. They toss in the fire and you close in on the sled and you see the sled says Rosebud. And the thing I love about that is it's basically saying, like, this man who kept trying to make himself into this huge deal that became this larger than life figure in the public eye, that had all of this money and all this stuff and everything that you could possibly want. He ultimately only wanted to recapture that little bit of joy he had in his childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is his entire arc and his entire journey.
Yeah. And so then Rosebud becomes a much bigger, existential thing that it mentions a few times that he's always trying to get the next thing that he can't have, or control things, basically. And this is the one thing that always eluded him, and he could never get back to this childhood feeling. It's really great. And that final shot with all the crates and everything. So the reporter and his kind of team, I guess, kind of walk around talking and kind of wrap up. They think they're wrapping up the story of, I guess, Rosebud was just some nonsense or something. But he kind of says something about all these things make up a man's life or something like that. And that's kind of the sense you get from the movie, because we've had all these little bits and pieces, like you mentioned, like seeing the personal side of who this man was, and seeing a life from beginning to end. But then also that's what the shot of all the crates absolutely has that feeling too, because it starts close and then it zooms out and then it pans over. There's just huge, huge amount of stuff. And it's like, this is all that's left of this guy. What a legacy on one hand, because he was such a big deal, but also nothing important is left, and his Rosebud is being burned in the fire. So yeah, it's really an amazing kind of bittersweet ending.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why this movie is so revered. It's because it has all the elements. And I feel like a lot of people talk about Citizen Kane and they go, well, it's up there because it is thought of as being this huge innovative movie, and that's the reason it's number one. And you know what? Yeah, it is hugely innovative, and it is very important in the echelon of film history, because it made all of these innovations in terms of camera and lighting and sound. But it still also is a great film because it tells a story and it tells it well. Ultimately, what makes a good movie is when you tell a good story and you tell it well.
Absolutely.
So
there
you go.
There you have it. That's Citizen Kane. So let's talk a little bit. So we talked quite a bit about Orson Welles, and he's, you know, the main guy for this. He directed, wrote, and starred in it.
In every respect possible, he is the main guy.
he had a writing partner on it, though, Herman J. Mankiewicz, who we talked about the Mankiewicz family quite a bit a few episodes back. Tell him again, just briefly, his connection to the family.
So Herman Mankiewicz had been working in town for a while in Hollywood. He had made quite a few films dating back to the silent era, when a writer's job would be to write the scenario and to write the titles, you know. And then he came into the 30s, and the first really significant movie he makes in the sound era that he wrote is Dinner at Eight. Dinner at Eight was this all-star cast movie that had, you know, a couple Barrymores and Gene Harlow and a bunch of other people. And and then he, so he's at MGM during this period. At that point in time, you are typically under contract to a single studio. And even if you're a writer, people think about the actors being under contract, but that's extended to directors and writers as well. And so he was writing for MGM for a time. And through, I'm not quite sure what factors led to him going over and writing for Citizen Kane. But he, because at the point Citizen Kane comes into his filmography, he starts writing for quite a few different studios. So he probably became more of a freelancer as time went on and got partnered up with Orson Welles to do Citizen Kane, and this is now what he's remembered for. But the reason why I like talking about Herman Mankiewicz is because he's part of this family that has just humongous footprint in cinema history. Because we talked a little bit about this with All About Eve. Joseph Mankiewicz was his brother, and he wrote and directed All About Eve, as well as a movie that he also won Best Director and Screenplay for, called Letter for Three Wives. And then they each had children and grandchildren who ended up being intrinsically connected to the industry. And Joseph Mankiewicz had kids that were, had a kid who was very intrinsically connected to the political side of life. And so the Mankiewicz family is Hollywood royalty. So as much as Orson Welles made a huge imprint on film, the fact that this also includes a Mankiewicz is something to be said. And there is a television series, I believe. Is it a movie or a TV film that's being made right now about the Mankiewicz family?
It's a movie. It's called Mank. And
yes,
I'm trying to remember who is playing in that, because it's I'm really excited about it.
Yes, here it is. It's Gary Oldman is playing Herman Mankiewicz.
Yes, that's right. And David Fincher is the director. So yes, get David excited Fincher about that.
And Tom Burke is going to be Orson Welles. Whoever Tom Burke is, I'm sorry, sir, I do not know you. You're an English actor though, so you know British people. Rah rah.
Yes.
And then Amanda Seyfried is in it as Marion Davies, who we were talking about a second ago. So Mank is going to center around the writing of Citizen Kane. So whatever little information I know about his actual involvement and whatever, however he was able to.
We can all fact check Rance in a few months when this movie comes
out. Yes, you can all fact check me. You'll forget anything I said that's inaccurate in a few months. But it is going to be a Netflix film. Yes. So look for that.
I'm excited for that.
Look for that. I mean, who knows if it'll have a theatrical run or not, because A, it's Netflix, and B, who knows if we have movie theaters.
Yeah, seriously. Charles Dance is in it too. He's
he's
the Lannister guy. So I know from Game of Thrones he's Tywin Lannister. But
that's
he's in a lot of other stuff too.
Yeah, and Lily Collins, who has been in some stuff. My cousin Lily. I don't think she's my, she's Phil Collins's daughter though.
Gotcha.
That's funny. I just assume anyone with Collins, I just call
them
my
related
cousin,
to you. Yeah.
You know, even though I have a very popular last name, it's,
yeah.
Well, assume I'm related to all of them.
Speaking of personal connection, and Mankiewicz's, I think we said this in the previous episode where we talked about this, but you have worked really closely with Ben Mankiewicz, who works for TCM. So that's pretty cool.
Yes. Oh, I did. I guess I should mention that Ben Mankiewicz, who is the primetime host for Turner Classic Movies, and has been the primary host since Robert Osborne died a few years ago, and has been on the channel for, I don't know, like 15 or so years now. He is someone who I have gotten to know quite well, because I do assistant work for him. I have escorted him at the Turner Classic Movie Film Festivals for a few years. Escorted means take around. I feel like I should clarify that.
Sounds a little shady. No, well, it's funny. I mean, you hear if I tell about that Facebook video you reshared recently?
Yeah, I didn't even mean to reshare. There's a Facebook video, and it's if you look at my Facebook, Rance Collins, you can see the video because it's set for the world to see. It's funny, you know, how sometimes somebody will comment on something that's like 3 years old, yeah, and then suddenly everybody's looking at it again.
Yeah, it came
and
up my
that's
timeline.
What happened,
yeah,
with that video. Yeah, I at the end of every year, which is the thing I will most miss about the festival this year.
Yeah.
At the end of every festival for the last I don't know 4 or 5 years, because I have been the handler basically for Ben. We have shot a rap video at the rap party. And every time he
doesn't know
he's
your
very
name.
Funny. He pretends like my name is, he doesn't know my name. And he does, I swear he knows my name. And we do a shtick together, yeah, and there are actually three of these videos that you can,
yeah,
watch.
I remember
on my Facebook.
Seeing a different one too, so I'll have to go find them all. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's really quite worth it. The and he is, I gotta tell you, as somebody who comes from a lineage of writers, I also write on air scripts for him on Turner Classic Movies. And he edits every script for all the intros and outros for his movies. And he is very difficult to, and the reason why that he has writers is because he does so many movies, yeah, intros so many movies every month. He couldn't, you know, the workload is just too much for one person. But so there's a few of us who the work's divided up against, and then he takes the scripts and he edits them. And he is very particular and very difficult to write for, because he has such a high standard for what he wants those scripts to be, that you know, sometimes you write something and your work gets completely gutted. But it's because he holds such a high standard for what he puts out on television, even for just a 2-3 minute intro to a movie. And I think that probably comes from a long line of having perfectionist, yeah, as family members.
That's really fascinating. Yeah. His intros are amazing. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things about TCM. That's so much what I appreciate about TCM. And I realized, like, the best way to have some context before or after you watch a movie is look up the host intro on YouTube, because they're out there. It is, like, you can... For people that love DVD special features, it's like the ultimate way to watch classic movies is on
it
TCM.
Is.
So, yes.
Yeah, and they have lots of... I mean, like, the entire reason that I haven't let go of cable is because of TCM. And I'm one of very few, yeah, who has DirecTV. But believe me, just so you all know, you can get really good deals nowadays because
they
nobody
to
has
have
it anymore,
yeah,
and they
they're desperate.
They will lock you into like a 2 years for $50 or whatever,
yeah,
deal, which is pretty good for, you know, hundreds of channels.
Yeah.
But and they'll throw the internet in with it, and it's amazing. I have TCM for that purpose. And the thing that I like about just turning it on, and really the entire reason I still have cable, is just so I can turn on TCM and it just like is whatever's on is on. And yeah, in between the movies, because it's commercial free, it only has TCM related commercials, and they show trailers and short films and newsreels and little behind the scenes specials where they have little highlight interviews they've made with various people over the years that they show in between the movies that add additional context into whatever it is that you are watching on the channel. And it's a fun channel to just have on because it is educational in an mm-hmm. entertaining way. And you never know, sometimes, I mean, not every movie that was made 80 years ago is good, believe me, but but you always you happen onto gems all the time, mm-hmm. just by turning on that channel.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yes, we are not sponsored by TCM, but you would think it with but how much they, we love it, but I also really love to see
they do pay me money.
Yes, so maybe we indirectly are
one of my employers.
So. I turned it on the other day, actually, and so my son is 5, but he really loves musicals and like anything with singing in it. And I was like, yeah, I wonder if he would like this. But we turned on Fiddler on the Roof, and he was getting so into it. And I was like, yes, this is amazing. He was like,
if he were a rich man.
Yeah, that song was on. He's dancing around the barn.
What's the name of that actor? He's
Rev Tevye.
Name.
I'm trying to remember.
Tevye, yeah.
That's the character name.
He's a one word. No, Tevye is the character. But I feel like the actor has like a one word.
I think you're right.
Am I making that up?
You're right. I think it is
Fiddler. Oh, Topol.
Topol, yeah.
Topol. Topol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who played it on Broadway for years, and then...
And then Norman Jewison directed that, who... And Norman Jewison's the guy who did In the Heat of the Night, and... Moonstruck, and... Jesus Christ Superstar, and... lots of... but In the Heat of the Night is what I was thinking of, so...
I'm a big Fiddler on the Roof fan, too, so that's...
There you go. Because of the TCM Film Festival, I have been in a room with Norman... With that director, Norman Jewison, who's alive and super old, but he, I was also in a room with Sidney Poitier. So,
oh my gosh, amazing,
right?
The life you lead,
the life I lead. But this year, I'm not going to be in a room with anyone. I'm going to be in a room by myself, and I'll turn on TCM, and enjoy that.
Well, that I think is as good a place as any to end our discussion of Citizen Kane and our entire season with just some classic movie love. Classic movies, as we mentioned, I think are the best way to experience history, the best way to experience culture of days gone by, and just to feel, you sort of feel a kinship with older generations. I find that you were young and experienced things that I experienced, at some point, and you still have experiences, and those shouldn't be discounted. I think I've garnered a lot of that over the years just from watching old movies. So anyway, we are moving on to a little bit of a different focus in the next season, but let's take a moment and just remember classic movies are amazing, and keep watching them. Don't be afraid of something just because it's in black and white.
Yeah, that's my message to all. I'm glad that we did all black and white for this series.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Rance. We could not have done this without you, and I so appreciate you being a part of this.
I had a great time. Movie, everybody. Enjoy all the movies.
Yes. And that's a wrap for season 3. I absolutely could not have done this without the wonderful Rance Collins, down to the film selections and the discussion choices, and not to mention hours of his time to record all of this. Thank you, Rance, and you are always welcome back. If I have it my way, this will not be Rance's last appearance on Arthouse Garage. Looking ahead now to season 4 that we're calling again the Arthouse Starter Pack. Just like season 3 was a gateway into classic cinema, this will be a gateway into art films. The very next episode we will discuss Tokyo Story, directed by Yasujiro Ozu. I have never seen Tokyo Story. I've actually never seen a film by Ozu, though I hear his name all the time in film discussions. By all accounts, this movie is a big deal, and I'm very excited to experience it. This movie is currently streaming on the Criterion Channel, as well as on Canopy, which a lot of libraries offer for free. You can also rent or purchase it on most digital platforms. Here's what the Criterion Channel says in the description for Tokyo Story. A profoundly stirring evocation of elemental humanity and universal heartbreak, Tokyo Story is the crowning achievement of the unparalleled Yasujiro Ozu. The film, which follows an aging couple's journey to visit their grown children in bustling post-war Tokyo, surveys the rich and complex world of family life with the director's customary delicacy and incisive perspective on social mores. Featuring lovely performances from Ozu regulars Chishu Ryu and Setsugo Hara, Tokyo Story plumbs and deepens the director's recurring theme of generational conflict, creating what is, without a question, one of cinema's mightiest masterpieces. So, yes, I'm excited to watch this. I can't wait to dig into it next time, so make sure to give it a watch and join us. Till then, follow at Arthouse Garage on Instagram, Letterboxd, Facebook, and Twitter, and find all of our written and video content at arthousegarage.com. Subscribe to the monthly newsletter for movie news and streaming recommendations at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. And if you want to support the show, leave a rating or review on your podcast app or buy a shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. We actually just added a new shirt design, so check that out. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, keep it snob free.